it up for fruit. To bring a smile to the face and to do it in some way that's ideally creative. So this year's Purim Torah that came around to at least some of us on the internet is Masechet Ovama Metzia. This is Masechet Ovama Metzia. So you can guess what that's patterned on. We are reading Baba Metzia. So this is Ovama Metzia. This is Masechet Ovama Metzia. And I just like to read it. It's extremely cleverly done. It's just, well, first of all, a disclaimer. The fact that I have given this to you in no way indicates my assent to anything that it says. I just think that it's clever. It's clever. It just shows what Talmud heads do a lot of the time. You know, when they're not studying their Talmud, they're making it up. And that piece of the community that does that, and in fact is able to do that, tends to be somewhere in the Orthodox world, and slightly more Orthodox world, and you don't have to be a political maven to know that in the Jewish community today, the Orthodox world tends to be supportive of the Republicans, more so than, let's say, 50 years ago. And so this will reflect that perspective. It's very clever because you remember that when we studied Masechet Kiddushin, Ha'isha niknet b'shalosh prachim, a woman is acquired in three ways, with Kesef, Shtar, and Bia. That was the Mishnah then. So here in this Masechet Ovama Metzia, it starts off HaKesef Nikne. Instead of HaKesef Kone, that money purchases, but money is acquired Al Yedei HaMemshala, by the government, Bishtar. Now, look up to the right side, top right side, and you have Rashi. So Rashi means Shtar, means by taxes. Mas, taxes. Taxes. So money is acquired by the government through taxes. Ubin mishicha. Mishicha is classically you take the animal and you pull the animal into your domain. Literally means pulling. So look at the Rashi for mishicha. Al korcho. Al korcho, against his will. In other words, the government takes money through taxes or against your will. Against your will. That's number one. Okay, that's period after Mishnah. Ha'ezrach nikneh, the citizen is acquired, b'tikva v'shinui. And look at the Rashi, tikva and shinui. Is it saying that? B'tikva v'shinui. And it gives it in Laz. Laz means in the vernacular, which normally means French in Rashi. Here you can read it in English, hope the change. Hope the change. So that's tikva v'shinui. Of course, that is the meaning of tikva and shinui in Hebrew. So the citizen is acquired through hope and change. The Odei HaMemshalah, those who work for the government, Konim et atzmam, they acquire themselves, b'shein v'ayin. Shein v'ayin is the classical, was in the Torah reading 2 weeks ago, three weeks ago in Mishpatim. Shein v'ayin is that a slave acquires his freedom if you injure his tooth or his eye. Okay, that's what it says. So here the text is that somebody who works for the government, Obdei Memshalas, people who work for the government, acquire themselves b'shein v'ayin, through a tooth or an eye. And here you can see konim et atzmam in the Rashi. Konim et atzmam in the Rashi. Bigmara mefaresh. So this is explained in the Gemara. The classic style here. de mekablim scharam afilu liachar shen gamru mila avot. They receive their salaries even after they finish working. And then pension belas. In other words, they go out on pension. They continue to make their money. Bishen v'ayin. So I explained to you what that means, a tooth or an eye. Sheyesh lem afilu michush ba'alma b'shein ba'ayin. If they have even the slightest problem in their tooth or in their eye, that they get a permanent pension. You get a permanent pension. Okay. Harifu'an niknet. Here you get to the heart now of the issue of the day. Medical care is acquired. Begera on kesef, through the loss of money. Through the loss of money. Go to the Rashi. Harifu'at, through a deficit, right? Rashi. Harifu'ah. She you call in yane rifu'ah mishel atzibur. That all matters of health should come from the public. From the public. The public should pay for everything. Gera'on kesef, deficit of money. Rashi. Call mi sheyesh lo rifu'ah shav. Everybody who has medical care now, Goreh mikaspo, he pays an indebtedness, l'shalem l'acharin, to other people. Okay. And the last one is, v'ha energia yiroka niknet b'chalifin. Green energy is acquired, energia yiroka, look at the Rashi, k'dei l'hasil et ha'olam. In order to save the world, hitkinu, they made a law, shiyu kol echad monea milihishtamesh bidvarim amilchamanim et olam, that each person would be prevented from using those things which heat up the world. Umikevan shiyesh anashim shi'ev shalehem lihimana, and since there are people for whom it is impossible to not do those things, Tiknu liknot energia. They made a law that they would have to purchase energy. Well, there's a technical, what do you call that?
Carbon,
what is it called? Carbon,
credit.
What?
Credit? Cap and trade. The law would be cap and trade.
Cap and trade, that's cap and trade. That's what he's talking about here. Mimisha monea yotel. You buy it from the person who uses less of it. That's what the Rashi says.
Oh, that's
the
carbon.
Okay. So I just wanted you to see how up to date the Talmud is. That it's being written even as we sit and breathe. Talmud is coming out again.
I can't imagine which political affiliation they have.
You can't imagine, for sure. I can't imagine it either. And you can see the translation of Rashi and the Tosafot. Oh, the Tosafot. There's a Tosafot here too. Let's take a look at the Tosafot. Okay, I'll show you the Tosafot. Bishtar. Bishtar. Okay, the first Tosafot on the top left side. Bishtar. That normally means a written document. And, of course, Rashi understood that to mean taxes. So the Tosafot say, perish pekundras mas. It says in the Rashi that means taxes. Vikasha, and that's difficult. This classic Tosafot is difficult. Leferusha, it's difficult to understand this. The hainu mishichah, because that would mean pulling something from the people. So it couldn't mean the same thing. Obviously, if there are two different concepts in the Mishnah says shtar and mishicha, shtar cannot mean the same thing as mishicha, and taxes are the same as pulling things out of people's hands. Okay? Ela nir'eh, rather, it makes more sense. The shtar hainu shtarei hadalar. What does shtar mean? Shtar means certificates of a dollar. That's what it must refer to. The Hamemshala Kona et HaKesef, because the government acquires money. Bamesh Madpisim Shtare Dollar, through their ability to print dollars. That's how the government acquires money, through the printing of dollars. Kafi Ritzonam, according to whatever will they have. They can print dollars to whatever they like. Teda de Kishem Shaloha Yamamon La Banking, Mishalem La Bale Chovotchalahem, Veloa Yamamon La Bale Abati, Mishalem Bishvil Batehem. Know that just as there was no money for banks to pay their depositors, I guess, would be the ones who had the creditors. There you go. Thank you. The creditors. Velo aya mamon lebalei abatim, and homeowners did not have money to pay for their homes. In the same way, who adin she'ein lamem shalak kesef mizuman. Similarly, the government has no real money. Ella, rather, shalamem shalom yesh zchut lahadpis kesef. Rather, the government has the right to print money. Ki'ilu yesh lahem kesef mizuman, as if they had real money. Okay. The style is terrific. It's obviously done by some Gemara copters, you say, somebody with a Gemara head, and they just have a good feel for the way the Talmud works in order to create a little bit of satire.
Al Gore, in the Hebrew, is there a meaning? Would there be a meaning for that?
Well, I didn't get that far.
On the left, please.
Yeah, no, I see, but I didn't see where it appears in the text.
What I mean is, would it mean anything in Hebrew?
We have to see. Probably, I mean, not necessarily, but it certainly could mean something. No, then it's not. It's meant simply as Al Gore, meaning Al Gore. It's not meant as a double entendre. It could in theory, but it doesn't in the context. Yeah, but it doesn't. It doesn't in the context, it doesn't mean that. It means Al Gore. Okay? Any questions on Masechet Obama Messiah? Okay, you got it?
Where did you find it?
It's up at the top. It says Obama Messiah. You know what I said at the beginning? This is Purim Torah. This is Purim Torah that was sent out over the internet, and one of our congregants sent it to me. You know, these things go out over the internet. God knows where they come from and where they go to. I looked to see that whether it was worthwhile looking at a second time. I thought it was cute.
Yeah,
it was cute. Questions? Yeah, my
question. Not considered sacrilegious.
Not considered sacrilegious. Considered good Purim Torah. Good Purim Torah. All kinds of things are done on Purim that are not considered sacrilegious. Yeah, you wouldn't find the stuff to be inappropriate. It's kind of good taste. And from a certain political perspective. You don't have a political perspective, it's not a good taste. Okay. Now, my question to you is, I know we did the Mishnah at the beginning, but did I skip the end of the Gemara? Did we read last time about the Ona'a as far as converts go? I think
just
I skipped
the Mishnah.
Yeah, I skipped, I think, from the end of the story that we, Haggadah we were doing to the next Mishnah. So let's go back. Excuse me, not that it's world-shaking, but it is a little bit interesting. This is 59b3. The left hand side of the page. Uh, Tanu Ravanan, the rabbi's time. Now this was, the Mishnah was almost this, but this is a Baraita which restates the Mishnah. Amni'aneh v'ger over b'shlosha lavim. The one who verbally wrongs a convert has transgressed on three negative prohibitions. So we had seen, we had learned in the Mishnah that one of the forms of using words to hurt concerns the convert to Judaism. One is not supposed to remind the convert of where he came from. You don't say to the convert, when the convert eats kosher food, the mouth that eats that food, your ancestors, hey, do you realize what they were eating? You don't remind the convert of where the convert came from. Okay? So now it expands out and it says that the person who does wrong the convert transgresses three laws of the Torah. The halacha tso, and the one who oppresses him transgresses two laws. So this in a way is trumping up the issue. It's not just a moral issue. It's not just that logically this falls into the general category of ona'at devarim, but really we even have further textual evidence, evidence that will come from the Torah on the seriousness of such a transgression. Maishna mi'aneh, what is different about someone who wrongs a convert? In other words, what is different, because you're not really learning what's different per se, but you're learning the scriptural sources now. Where do we learn about the scriptural sources? And we know there have got to be three of them. So in theory, the Maishna is, there are three sources of ona'at devarim, that you're not allowed to hurt a convert with words. Secondly, there are two sources you're not allowed to oppress the convert. So Maishna, what is the difference then between the two? There's hurting with words and oppressing. Why three for one and two for the other? Why is one worse than the other? We don't even know, of course, what they mean, what the difference is between them. They could mean the same thing. Maishna mi'aneh dichtive, because it is written, shloshalavi. Three times in the Torah there is a negative command. The ger lo toneh, you shall not wrong a convert. So there it's direct, it's said very directly. The chi agur itcha ger ba'ad sechem lo toneh. When a ger, a convert, lives with you in your land, you shall not wrong him. So it's the second time where lo toneh actually applies to the ger, is very specific. And then the third one is the one that was in our Mishnah. Lo tonu ish et amito. A person should not wrong his fellow. We learned about that, that refers to ona'at devarim. There were two sources where it says you shall not wrong. One of them was ona'at devarim, the other one was ona'at kesef. And we learn then that one of the ramifications of one of the Atavarim in the oral law was that it affected the ger, the convert. Okay, the ger bichlal amitohu. And we learn that a ger, a convert, is considered to be part of the general category of his fellow. And that we have learned before. Lo chatzo nami. So now the Gemara says it's true also as far as oppressing the convert. Shlosha ketive, that there are three things written about oppressing a convert. Remember that the Baraita said there were two things. Now the Gemara says, no, there aren't two things, there are three things. Because immediately the Gemara says, why three, one, and two the other? Now the Gemara says, no, it's three and three. And therefore there is no problem. And sometimes that's a way of dealing with the Gemara's problem. It's not that there's three for one and two for the other. They're both three. How? It's got to prove its point. Shosha ketivi, v'lo tilchatzenu, you shall not oppress him, meaning the convert, in the context. The ger lo tilchatz, you shall not oppress a convert. V'lo tiyelo kenoshe, and you shall not be to him as a creditor, to the poor debtor as a creditor. The ger bichlalhu, and the convert is considered in that general category of creditor. Sorry, as, no, the debtor, really. That's the implied debtor. You shall not be as a creditor, namely somebody to oppress him. Ela achad ze v'achad ze shlosha. The Rambam concludes, no, it's three of one, three of the other, they're just the same. Okay? Now the Tanya, another Baraita comes. Rabbi Eliezer HaKadol Omer. Rabbi Eliezer the Great says, Itne ma hizhira Torah v'lav mekomot. Why did the Torah warn in 36 places the Amela Binim Vav Mekomot? And some say that in 46 places, Begir, concerning ascending a convert. Mitnesh Surora, because his inclination is bad. Namely, Surora means a ger, somebody who comes out of a background of a, let's just use the pagan as the extreme example, because in their context that's what they were thinking about. That person has got a lifetime of prior experience. You don't want to hurt that person's feelings, because it's very easy to send that person back to their former life. Okay? And therefore you have to be extremely sensitive to where the ger is coming from. So that is the force of what is said here. Okay? My dichtiv, what is it meant when it is written, the ger lo tonev lo tilchatsenu ki geri meyitim beretz Mitzrayim? You shall not wrong a convert, nor shall you oppress him. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. We've learned in a Baraita, Rabbi Natan Omer, and Natan says, Mum shebecha alto malachavecha. A blemish that you have yourself, you should not say to someone else. In other words, you shouldn't make, where do we Jews come from? We come from very humble circumstances. We come from the family of Abraham. What was Abraham's father doing? He was an idolater. He was an idolater. So, you know, don't think that you're such a big shot. We all come from the same spot. And therefore, mum shebecha, you look at, when everybody looks at himself, no matter how great we think we all come from humble beginnings. That may be the case for the convert, or the case for every born Jew as well. So, be sensitive to all of those things. I knew the Amre Inche, this is what people mean when they say, there's a popular saying, these kifles a kife bidiotke, that if someone was hanged in one's family, lo neimale lachave zakef tinita, he should not say to his surviving relative, the surviving relative should not say to his fellow, hang this fish up. In other words, like if a person has in his family something that's upsetting, even by indirection, you have to be very sensitive. You can't say hang a fish up, because as soon as you say hang, he remembers that somebody in his family was hanged, and so it's upsetting to him. So here, this is the high level of sensitivity that you have to use when you use words in order to be sure that we do not, even without meaning it, hurt another person's feelings. And this is, it's a nice way to end, I think, this section on Una'at Devarim. That the Gemara is really calling for a very high level of sensitivity in language. It's out of style. but it's a very, very important idea. Any questions, comments?
If there were three sources in the Torah for hurting a convert or oppressing a convert, don't they have to account for why they would, don't they have to be three different things that it was saying?
No, no, it doesn't have to. And that it can leave up to the rabbis to do. Okay, now what do you mean by oppression? What is oppressing? But here it's just eventually coming back to ona atavarish. It's all really coming back to the use of words, and they need to be sensitive with the words that you use, particularly when people are coming from compromised circumstances in their own personal lives.
When the Torah refers to a ger living in the land of Israel, it means a convert?
No. In rabbinics, when the rabbis read the word ger in the Torah, it means a convert. When the Torah uses it, I have no doubt about the fact that it does not mean a convert. It means a stranger. And there are different qualities of strangerness, strangerliness in the land. A ger, there's a quality called a ger toshav. That is a stranger who has certain residency. Then there is the complete stranger. You were strangers in the land of Israel, in the land of Egypt. Okay, so it's used in a variety of different ways. But when the rabbis read it in the Talmud, it means convert. That's what it means. And they then reread the Torah to mean convert. Of course, maybe that's what it meant, but that's what you learn from the oral law. Certainly not the plain meaning of the term.
Or again, Gerim in Babylonia.
Why? Oh, you mean, oh, that they were strangers.
They
weren't converts, but they were strangers.
So,
but maybe, but that's not what they saw it as meaning, clearly as meaning convert. And just think, you know that in again we were talking about this last time, early Christian times, there was a fair amount of conversion to Judaism. Judaism was a monotheistic religion, was a desirable religion. You have to keep that in mind also in terms of understanding the Torah of Paul, the Apostle Paul. Because there was a lot of interest in monotheism in the ancient world. You read Greek philosophy. The Greek philosophers eventually come out to be monotheists. Aristotle is a monotheist. They clearly see the philosophical sophistication of monotheism. Whether that's what the Torah is talking about or not, I'll leave for another discussion, but that's how they understood it anyway. And therefore there was a lot of interest in conversion in the ancient world. And remember, Professor Baron, in his massive, many-volumed History of the Jews, do you know Baron's History of the Jews? Published by the Columbia University Press, the classic, really the most important work of the 20th century in Jewish history. He wrote it in English, published by Columbia. He has a fantastic introduction to that. It's a very, very interesting introduction. I don't agree with the introduction, but it's so good that it doesn't make any difference if you agree with it or not. It's a great masterpiece. It's a masterpiece, his introduction. It's on the theology of history. It's just a great masterpiece. And one of the facts that he shares with you in his the first part of his history is that at the time of the destruction of the temple, he says there were as many Chinese as there were Jews. Get that. I mean, realize there are many Chinese as there were Jews. So there are a few more Chinese today than there are Jews, which just shows the difference of history. And we have a very, very different subsequent history for the next 2,000 years or so. But way back when, that's what Baron says. It's startling. It's true. It's amazing. But in the ancient world, monotheism was desirable. Eventually what Paul is able to come off with is a type of monotheism that is simplified. Many of the Jewish readings of early Christianity are, he had a much more user-friendly product than we have. And I think it's quite true. There was one law. We have 613 commandments. There's one law. The law of love. Right? And that's why you have in Paul these anti-Paul has to deal with the issue of a law because he's essentially a good salesman. And he's selling in the Hellenistic world something that people are really very interested in. But they wouldn't be interested in it if it has too much baggage, too much of the hard stuff. So you sell it to them in terms of the easy stuff and the good stuff, which is love. Love is very good, been very popular. It's the most popular idea in the Western world to this day. That's the way to really make money, is to figure out how to get out the word on love. Most importantly, that's what everybody is interested in this country. It's a Christian country. Love is still the principal issue. It's the issue in all of our American morality. American morality is totally Christian. Totally Christian. All based on the notion of love. So it's love is the thing. So Paul was very good at that. He really was a terrific salesman. He produced, you know, the Apple iPod of his time and sold like hotcakes. Really sold like hotcakes. Just to bring it back to Purim, one of the interesting things at the end of the Megillah is that the Megillah says at the end, if you pay attention, it's just fascinating, it's in the ninth chapter. I believe it's the ninth, either the end of the eighth, the beginning of the ninth chapter of the Megillah of Esther. It talks about the Jews defending themselves, and they killed X number of the Persians, and then they killed 500 in Shushan one day, and then Esther asked the king for a second day, and they killed 300 the second day, the total of 800 of the anti-Semites in Shushan, the capital, who were killed. And then it goes on, and it says all the celebrations that the Jews did, and then it says, the Hayu Harbe Mityahadim. Many Gentiles converted to Judaism when they saw the strength of the Jews. Fascinating thing. And that's always been the case, that success on the battlefields also brings along a lot of potential fellow travelers. Because you've got intellectually something that they admire, but nobody admires losers. You can have a very good product, but if you're a loser, you're not going to sell that well. So when you got a good product and you're a winner, mityahati, the people convert to Judaism. So there too, you had it even in the Book of Esther. That's what I think.
In the text here, I mean, in the context, I wonder if there's anything that you find in it.
M.R. Vista.
Where even though the message is to be very sensitive and to not use words that could be injurious, nevertheless, who is it here? Eliezer, who says the reason you have all this emphasis is Ignatius Surura. That's not such a nice thing to say about a ger, about a convert. So did they just think that the gerim are not going to read the Talmud, or did they?
I'm not sure. Having dealt with converts for many, many years, as long ago as those were for yesterday, so it's a converts. Are their own reality. Own reality. It's an interest. And I don't know what Surah-Ra means either. Surah-Ra is translated here in the English as his inclination is bad. Doesn't mean that. Doesn't mean that. I'm not sure what it means, but it doesn't mean his inclination is bad.
Maybe that he will move to a bad thing. Maybe go back to where he was before.
I think.
Like Yasur.
Yeah.
And we call it.
I read it as something like, you know, that person could go back to where he came from. La sur le tzadara. Could remove him, could move in that direction. And that, I think, is fairly accurate. I mean, I think that's something that in a synagogue, for example, we are very concerned, and frequently I will just drop little hints here and there to tell people, you know, be particularly welcoming of so-and-so. And frequently I won't say why, because you don't want to say too much. Sometimes people make it known that they're converts, or people know these people, and they know that they're converts, and we just try to reach out to them. Where is the point where the reaching out, you reach out, but you reach out because you know that if you don't reach out, somebody's going to fall back. They're going to go in another direction. It's not a static position to be in. It's a very difficult position to be in for the convert. Therefore, you have to really work actively on drawing, that's my feeling, you have to always draw the convert near. You can't just let the convert stagnate.
Do you see statistically over the population that is all converts falling back?
Depends. Probably the answer is statistically not much evidence. It's my guess. Somebody did a study of this a while ago, and they were comparing the reform movement and conservative movements. Reform movement, where there's no requirement for conversion. But people say, you know, we all have a Jewish house. So they tried to study that statistically. Is that statement of will, how often does that work? And what is the statistical turning away from that? As opposed to the person who goes through the conversion process, goes to the mikveh, makes a commitment to Jewish observance and so on. And that, I remember who was studying this, was Cohen was studying it, one of these statisticians in New York. He found there was a startling difference between the two. That the traditional conversion really resulted in a pretty good degree of stability compared to the more ephemeral type of conversion. There was a tremendous difference between the two. I don't know, though, that one has had enough time to study the next question, which sort of implied, if not, unless you meant it directly, and that is, you know, just what's the bottom line in terms of converts? And that, I would think, it's very hard to judge that in a generation. And the key thing will be after 3-4 generations. That's going to be the interesting thing. What are the children of converts doing? If somebody converts to Judaism, you know, in our fold, let's say in the conservative movement, that's the study I would like to see. When their children get married, who are they marrying? Who are they marrying? I'd like to see that study done, I think we're just now getting the data that would make a meaningful study, because this is the progress of these things. We're just now getting the generation of people who have had children who are now growing up, you know, in any numbers to learn anything from.
That's really the only way to measure whether a conversion takes, isn't it? I mean, how do you measure if one commits to observing Jewish? How do you measure going forward?
You could do a titus check, as they say.
Yeah, all right. So really, the effect on the next generation is really the only valid.
I would think that from the sociologist's perspective, that would be the measure you'd want to measure. And it wouldn't be, you know, the religious, it wouldn't be how many seders you go to, you know, even something as general as that. Is widespread in the community, and it's not wearing sitters, putting on so on. Either, that's what I think.
But the children do not necessarily know the history of their parents' conversion.
They don't have to. The question is, what do they learn at home? You know, what is the level of identity which parents either consciously or unconsciously convey to their children?
Obviously, the new religion.
Well, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see the study of that to see really what happens. There was some kind of conversion process. Nothing like what we have today.
Because the attitude is here, from this man pointed out to this reference, adopting Judaism, the rabbi seemed to think it was a kind of rehab. You're giving up some kind of bad habit. You've got a
Cleveland, but finally the path. The odds are you probably relapse unless you get a lot of support from your immediate community.
Okay. There's some truth to that.
Is there a mass conversion in Edom? And then Herod is descended from converted?
Yes, you have a variety of conversions in the early Talmudic period. You have the Herod, that's true, you have that. You have in the biblical period, you have conversions. But in both those examples, the biblical period, you have some mass conversions of the Sumerians. And the rabbis have to deal with, are these valid conversions? Are they valid conversions? And the criteria usually is, were they done with or without duress? With or without, and not how many times were they put on tefillin, or they keep kosher, but was this done under duress or not? So yes, you do have examples of that, but that again, that's from that period. That's what I'm saying, that's the Talmudic period, where you do have a fair amount of conversion going on. Professor Shai Cohn wrote the book on this subject. Shai Cohn, a friend of mine who's Professor Brown, and he wrote the book, and he did it for polemical purpose. I mean, he's a historian. And part of the reason why he did the historical study of conversion in the Talmudic period was polemical, to show that what modern rabbis say is simply not true. The Talmud itself doesn't say the things that we say. The Talmud is not half as scrupulous as is, let's say, the modern rabbinate. Probably even the modern conservative rabbinate, let alone the Orthodox rabbinate. So part of his historical study was to show that. And for what it's worth, it's interesting to see.
Yeah. I'm just wondering today, are there many kind of converts to Judaism? Basically, just spouses, somebody marrying a Jewish person and wanting to convert.
Don't say just.
No, I mean, is there other people, singles or other families, not Jewish, that are converting as well?
Not in droves. Although, I'm one of those rabbis who doesn't count out seriousness of a lot of conversion that's done for the sake of marriage. I was at one point a pious follower of Rabbi Louis Jacobs. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the writings of Rabbi Louis Jacobs, one of the great Jewish scholars of our time. Louis Jacobs was a rabbi in London. He was a very classic, traditional Jewish scholar, but he was willing to speak about the credibility of biblical criticism. It's all you had to do in London in the 50s and the early 60s when he started doing this. Essentially, he was blackballed by the London rabbinate as being a heretic. So after Louis Jacobs became a heretic, the London rabbinate always had the English rabbinate had an ambivalent relation to Louis Jacobs, because nobody could doubt that he was probably the greatest English Jewish scholar of the last 100 years. And he was a traditional scholar. He was not a modern scholar. I mean, he was a modern scholar, but he was also a traditional scholar. The things that he wrote a history of Chabad Hasidism, which the Chabadniks read. I mean, that kind of a guy. So, but he was willing, and in England, you're not allowed to do what the Queen says that you don't do. If you go against what the authority says in that culture, it's not like America where you have to go. You're not good unless you go against what the authority says. In our culture, the only way you can sell a book is to be against everything and to show that everything you say, nobody ever said before. English is exactly the opposite. You have to show that what you're saying is exactly what everybody said before, that all you're doing is re-saying it. So they're a different kind of a culture. So Louis Jacobs was a little difficult. And they had terrible problems with him. He was essentially marginalized, more or less, but in an ambivalent way, in the London rabbinate, until he died. So one year he came to the seminary. So I was then teaching full time in the theology, in what we call the philosophy department. It's been called the Department of Philosophies of Judaism. So Rabbi David Wolf Silverman was the chairman of the department. David lived in Riverdale. So these were the early days in the seminary, right after Gershon Cohn decided there should be departments. This was the early 70s. We never had departments because the stars of the seminary could not be in departments. They were the departments. So Professor Lieberman couldn't be in a Talmud department. It was impossible. So the whole concept, and Heschel couldn't be in a philosophy department because they could not be in departments. These people were too great to be in departments. You couldn't have departments who dealt with their subject. And that's the way the seminary used to be. So Gershon Cohn had this wonderful idea the seminary would be like Columbia. We'd have departments. So we had a philosophy department. It was the early years of the philosophy department. And David Wolf Silverman, who has written a lot, he was wonderful. He was very thoughtful fellow, and he then said we have to have social activities. So we had never had anything like that. Heschel never had a social activity. I mean, he's a European scholar. European scholars didn't invite students for dinner. I mean, maybe they did Shabbos once, but you didn't. There's no such thing as a sherry. You invite the students for sherry. It's like another world, totally different. These are yeshiva people. It's a different world. So we had a department, sherry, as it were, in David Wolf Silverman's home in Riverdale. So Louis Jacobs then was a member of our department. He came to teach in the seminary. He was a character. I mean, he was a very English gentleman, super English kind of gentleman. And so we're sitting there, and Louis Jacobs says, "By the way, you American rabbis, I see, are arguing about conversion. And I see that they are among the rabbis who say that if a person converts for marriage, they will not accept the convert." So we say, yes, that's right, Rabbi Jacobs, that's right. So he says, "Well, I want you to know that in London, I have one rule about a convert. Any convert who converts to Judaism without marriage, I throw them out." "They're all crazy. In order to convert to Judaism without marriage, you have to be a wild man, an idiot. Crazy, crazy as they come. I never saw one who was sane." So I heard what he said, and I said, "So interesting. Nobody ever said that before." So then I kept that in mind throughout all my years. And I was recently ordained. This was 1972, 3, something like that. So, you know, almost 40 years have gone by, and I've seen the wisdom of his words. He was a very great scholar.
There was an article, I guess, within the last week in the Times about the skinhead in Poland.
Oh, yeah. He found out he was Jewish.
Well, you've got that stuff now, too. Yeah. You've got the East Europeans who are discovering their Jewish roots and all those kinds of things. So it's
a neo-Nazi.
Anything can happen today. It's a very strange world. Okay? We'll move on. Okay, to the Mishnah. Now, we did this rather quickly last time. What I would like to do is to read it together with a Rashi tonight. Okay, again, where is the Rashi? The Rashi is on your inside border. Not exactly the inside border, but it's in the Rashi script. The script that you have trouble reading. Toward the inside border of the page. So, the Gemara says, "Ein me'arvim perot beferot, afilu chadashim bechadashim." One does not mix perot. Perot literally means fruits.
literally it means fruits, with fruits, even new ones with new ones. Now, let's read the Rashi. Ein me'arvin perot beferot, ba'al habayit, she'omer perot sadeh ploni, ani mocher lecha. A landowner, a house owner, literally, who says, these fruits, the fruits of this field, of a certain field, I am selling to you for such and such an amount of money. Kach v'chach se'in, so many bushels of that. Lo ya'arvenu b'perot sadeh acher. He should not mix them up with fruit from another field. So in other words, if he's saying that they're from this field, that's a material issue in the buyer's mind in terms of the quality of the produce. Okay? So it's not just, again, that they're chadashim b'chadashim. You might say, well, all produce that's of the same vintage, namely, you harvested it yesterday, should be dealt with equally. It's not true that it should be dealt with equally, because some fields are better than other fields, and the buyer may want to favor some fields as opposed to other fields, or certain farmers, because there could be a secondary level of sale going on here. Okay, next page. The Ein Sarich Lomar Chadashim V'Yishenim, and needless to say, you certainly don't have to say that a person is not allowed to sell, not allowed to mix in new produce into old produce. First we started out new produce and new produce. It's the same thing. Remember the field it comes from. Now, of course, we don't even have to say, in other words, it's a no-brainer to say that you can't mix new produce with old produce. Let's see the Rashi. Pasak limkor lo yishenim. He made a decision to sell him old produce. All right, that's what he said to the guy. He said, I'm selling you this produce. It's old produce. Lo yared bahen chadashim. The seller cannot mix into that new produce. Shehi yeshenim yibeshim. Because the old produce is dry. Tosim kemach yoter mina chadashim. And you can make more flour than from the new produce. Okay? So here we already see the transition. Not just produce per se, we're really talking about wheat. Apparently what they had in mind here was wheat. I've never bought wheat. I can't really say what it is. I know what it is to buy a tomato. I don't know what it is to buy a spark of wheat. Have you ever bought wheat?
You never had
bells?
You never bought
I bought it. Well, I had birds a long, long time ago, but it's in seeds.
That's wheat. Yeah.
I assume that they're just selling the wheat itself, and that the wheat must dry out.
They used to take them out of the ashibole.
Right.
You used to pull it out, and you get the wheat.
Well, I can't tell you for sure what's going on. My sense is that it's right. You're talking about something right after the harvesting. Or you're talking about drying it out right after the harvesting.
So then they sell it as bushel.
Correct. That's right. That's right. That's what you're talking about here. Okay.
But they mean wheat. Why didn't they say wheat?
That's a good question. Don't know the answer to that. Don't know the answer to that.
Maybe it was barley.
Okay. It could be that it is wheat. And because wheat is only one type of perot, perot could refer to wheat, but it refers to other things as well. And there are plenty of things that you can make wheat, you can make flour from. And wheat is only one of the things. We're now in that season. We're talking about the things you can make flour from. You can make, there are five types of grain, and then what's going to be the big issue of Pesach for the Ashkenazim is, you know how you call it? Kidneyot. Kidneyot, the legumes, what we call in English legumes. They're not legumes. It also is not a real translation. Kidneyot are those other things that in the ancient world they used to make flour from. All kinds of things. Peas they made flour from. Beans.
bees, they make beets they make flour bread. Yeah.
Beets?
Well, no, wait. Because she said beets doesn't mean that you can say you can't eat beets. Because since we...
I have my homework.
No, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter whether you can eat it or not. All of this is dependent on tradition.
What's the tradition about beets?
You can eat beets. Okay. Yes, one try. You can't. You don't have to
I think this could apply to, it doesn't specifically say flour.
Well, Rashi says that it's the kemach.
This could apply to, say, dates. The drier they are, the more honey you and the more syrup you would get out.
Possible.
Flavor
you get pretty good. Could be. We see that for certain types of produce, it may be true for wheat, and it may be true for dates, that something becomes more valuable when it's dry than before it's dry. It's not necessarily intuitive that that's the case, but certainly with certain types of produce it appears to be the case. Figs. I don't know, in the fig world, what costs more? Well, these days probably a fresh fig costs more than a dried fig.
Well, dried fruit is expensive. Dried apricots, dried strawberries.
It's expensive, right?
Concentrate the sugar and the flavor.
So it's more expensive, no? Huh?
No, there's another reason.
Huh?
You have to keep it until it becomes...
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. That also, there's time involved. And when you keep something for time is money. Right? Time is money. And if you decide that you're going to keep something... You're really putting an investment in that thing because you're slowing down your receipt of money if you were selling it, and you could then do something with that money. So that is true. That time is also a factor here. Okay, we go on. All right. Be'emet amru. Now that's an odd formulation. I'm sure you're sensitive to that. In truth, they said. Why would they say in truth? The yayin hitiru la'arev kasher berach. In the case of wine, they permitted the seller, to mix kasher berach, hard with soft, meaning strong wine with weak wine. Itnei shehu mashbicho, because that improves the weak wine. That improves the weak wine. So apparently here we see that there is a certain mixing, but the Gemara is going to qualify this. It's going to qualify that, but we see that as far as wine goes, if you are adding to the value of the wine, you're actually adding to it, doing something that's very desirable for the wine, then the assumption is that people usually would prefer to get more than they paid for rather than what they paid for. Okay? It's an interesting assumption because it's not necessarily obvious.
My copy of the Gemara doesn't say you don't look at it, you look at the coffee. No, the Russian part doesn't say, what's that phrase?
In Russian or in the Gemara? I was in the Gemara. Okay, let's look and see if there's any Rashi here. Mipnei shemashbicho, because it improves the quality. Now here I'm in the Rashi, it's three lines down on the Rashi. I'm on 60A1, but on the Hebrew side of the page, three lines down in the Rashi. Mashbicho. Kasher mashbiach et arach. The strong wine increases the value of the weak wine. Lefichach, pasakimo rach mi'arev bo kasher. Therefore, he was willing to fix out an amount where the weak wine, where the strong wine was mixed with the weak wine. Vechein ein sarich lomar chadashim biyishenim. Similarly, the Gemara could have gone on and say, of course you can't mix new with the old dafka, aval yeshenim bechandashim shapir dami. But if you take the old and you mix it with the new, that might appear to be good because you're increasing the value of something. Right? So that seems to be what's implied here, even though it's not said very specifically. Back to the text. Ein me'arvin shimrei yayin b'yayin. The seller may not mix the sediment of wine into the wine. Aval noten lo et shmarav. But he may put in its sediment.
Yayin b'yayin, in one shmarim in another wine.
Well, we don't know. First, the Mishnah itself is very hard to understand. And the Gemara is going to say this doesn't make any sense. So you've proposed one possible solution. There will be more than that. The Gemara will propose possible solutions to that. As it reads, it doesn't make any sense. It says that you're not allowed to mix sediment in, but you can put sediment in. So we have to figure out how that can be. Misha nitarev mayim b'yeno. Someone whose wine was mixed with hot water, lo yimkarenu b'chanut, he may not sell it in a store, ela imkein hodiyo, unless he informs, and we'll see that this means each customer, that it is diluted. V'lo letagar, and it's not enough to inform only the merchant, you can't sell it to the merchant, af al pi shahodiyo, even though you can tell the merchant that it's been diluted, she'eino ela l'ramotbo, because the merchant is buying it in order to cheat customers with it. Now that's interesting.
Yes, you don't know how he's going to deal with it once he gets it.
And here there's an assumption that the merchant, that nobody wants to buy cut wine in the first place. And if this merchant is the kind of guy who wants to buy it, merchants are not in the business of selling wine that's cut. They're in the business of selling good wine. So if this merchant, in fact, wants to buy that, this is a merchant you better watch out for. Okay? Therefore, in that case, you're not allowed to sell to them either. You can sell directly to the consumer because you're, as an individual, you're in a different position than a merchant. And you can inform, you are the source of the food, you can inform the merchant, the buyer, the consumer, directly. And that you are allowed to do. But you have to inform him. You can't just sell him without informing him. Okay? Makom shenagu lahatil mayim b'yayim. In places, and this is sort of a however statement, they have the word however here, which is fair. In a place where sellers have the custom to put water in wine, namely, in certain places, everybody knows that this is what is done. Every wine seller is selling wine that's cut with a certain amount of water. Yatilu, they may do that. So in other words, if it's your custom in the place for sellers to normally sell wine that's cut with water, then it's okay. What we're saying is where it's not the custom. Where it's not the custom because people have certain expectations when they go into the liquor store. And whatever those expectations are, you have to take those to heart. And you can't deceive anybody. Yativa. Hadagar notel me chamesh grenot. The merchant may take grain from 5 different threshing floors. Vinotein letoch negura achat, and put it into one silo. Right? In other words, when you thresh the grain, what do you do with it after that? There's not a lot of grain is necessarily threshed in one particular threshing, but you build it up, and of course the merchant wants to create a grain store, storage of grain. Well, the reality is that it's going to end up being mixed. And therefore, the assumption is of the buyer that always when you buy grain, unless you're buying it at the threshing floor, it's always going to be a mixed quantity. because that's the nature of that kind of business. That business deals in mixed quantities. I'm sure that's the case in a lot of different types of things. It's sometimes the case in wine. That wines, I notice in looking at the labels on wines, sometimes wines have to say if they're mixtures. If you have Cabernet with a mixed with Merlot, it has to say it on it. Because some brands are known for their Cabernet, and you assume when they just have their plain wine, well, there too, when it just says, you know, red wine, you assume it's a mixture. You would assume it's a mixture. So there's certain lingo, and there are certain customs that you learn about the place in which you live. And that's the case here. So the merchant is permitted to mix things. We said first the merchant can't mix. Now we're saying the merchant can mix if it's the nature of the way this thing is usually done. Likewise, he may take wine from five different presses and put it into one cask. Okay? The wine press itself also, the way wine is normally dealt with, it's normally dealt with in casks. It's not dealt with in whatever comes from a pressing, let's say, this particular pressing. Pressings are mixed together. And that's simply the way that the production normally proceeds. And then you can do that. So even though we said you couldn't mix, in these cases, it's the way that merchants do these things, and everybody knows that, and therefore you can do it. Provided that he does not intend to mix. Now that doesn't make any sense. He just said the opposite. Well, it's going to have to be maybe he said, maybe he means this or maybe he means that, because it's surely not there on the surface. Let's go back to the Rashi. Let's see what Rashi says about these things. Okay, we did mashpichot. Ein mervin shimrei yayin biyai. You are not allowed to mix the sediment of wine with wine. Bigmara mifareshla. It was right out of the Obama Messiah. Right? The Gemara Mefaresh, that's a common phrase in Rashi, the Gemara will explain this. Im Karenu Bachanut. Let's see, what is that referring to?
Water.
Only the Karenu, there we go. Right? Someone whose wine was mixed with water, Lo Yim Karenu Bachanut. You can't sell it in the store unless you make it clear to the buyer. Oh, well, this is the next piece. Yim karenu bechanut. He may sell it in the store. Pruta pruta. In other words, with each person. He can deal with the amount. With every user, right. With each individual person. That he is allowed to do. Okay, but he has to deal with each person separately. Ela im kein hodiyo, l'chol echad v'echad, to each and every person mehem. Let's see. Shemayim l'ravim bo, and he has to tell everyone that water is mixed in with that wine. V'lo letagar, but not to the merchant. Im karenu biyachad, ta'af al pi shemodiyo. Right, the merchant cannot sell it altogether. He can't sell it to the merchant altogether. The afal pisha modio, even though he would tell the merchant. The fisha eno lokeach elalaramot, because the merchant only buys these things in order to swindle people. The limochro bachanut, and to sell it in his store. A place where it is customary to add water to the wine, it is permissible. That's the key thing. Since it is the custom, right? It's the custom to do it. In kantaut, people will not err. They will not make a mistake. Shekol hayenot becheskat kein. Because all of the wines are assumed to be in that state. Hapagar notel michamesh granot, the seller may take from five threshing floors. Shakol yodimbo, because everybody knows that this is how it's done. Shalo gadlu bistotav, everybody knows that the wheat didn't grow, that this fresh wheat didn't grow in his fields. Shemibnei adam arbe lokeach, that he takes it from many people. Takes it from many people. Ubechezkat kein lokchim. And that's the assumption with which the buyer enters into the transaction. Migura was translated as silo in English. That's a nice translation. Otsar she'ogrim bo tvuat gorim. Sorry, tvua. A silo in which you gather together grain. Gorin hu shedashin. The gorin is a place where you do the threshing. Vizorin and winnowing. Vizorin bo et hatfu'a, you winnow the grain. Yederach hatagar liknot mi bale batim. And it is the practice for merchants to purchase from individual owners, from householders, bisha'at agorin, during the time of the threshing, ulachnis lemegurashalo, and to put it into his silo. So here, to understand these things, it's all realia. And the key thing is that if you know, the buyer knows, the seller knows, and there are certain customs, well, then there's no problem. What we are concerned about here is potential deception. Shelo, now here's the last phrase from the Mishnah. Upilvan shelo yehe mitkaven yarev. Remember, we saw that it was permissible for the merchant to take wine from five different presses. Presses meaning the wine press. And to put it into one cask. Bilvan shelo yehe mitkaven yarev. As long as he doesn't intend to mix. Now here's the Rashi. Ulehotzi kol liknot arov nimakom meshubach. As long as he doesn't intend to mix it, and to get the word out, liknot arov, and to sell most of it nimakom meshubach lare. So in other words, if a guy has, and he knows he's going to mix it, and he is about to sell this mixed wine, what Rashi is saying is, this is a case, it's okay to mix it, we know that that's all right, but you can't then go and say, this is Cabernet, right, without telling people. And so if you're going to mix it, even though it's okay to mix the stuff, when you're mixing different kinds of wine, there you have to announce it. You have to tell people, because some of it may be more desirable than the other stuff that's in it. And therefore, you're past the threshold. So even in wine, we're talking where you mix the same thing. But where you're mixing something that's significantly different enough, you have to make the buyer clear about that. Here again, so what Rashi is doing is he's saying, depends on the custom. Really, where it is customary to define things separately, some things are more valued than other things, you have to make it very clear to the purchaser what he's buying. You can't allow for any possible deception. Questions? So we're okay. Yes?
When we study about avlut, there was a paragraph about mixing wine, water. At that time we discussed that the water was not such a good quality, so part of the process was to mix it with wine so it would be more in a better quality altogether.
Well, that's part of it. The other part of it
so
is,
it's the other way around than what we are discussing here.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're right. There, let me just finish the other part of it. You're right. It could be, that's not the way the Gemara introduces it. The Talmud introduces it in the opposite direction. In Masechet Pesachim, for example, the 10th chapter, which is the chapter about the Seder, the Gemara says, Mazgu lo kos, they poured for him the first cup of wine. They poured for him the first cup of wine. That's what the Mishnah says. So you learn from that, first of all, that somebody else is supposed to pour your cup of wine. At the Seder, it's an important thing to remember in the Seder. You don't pour your own wine at the Seder. Somebody else has to pour the wine for you. So if you're pouring, if you're, let's say, the master of the Seder, and you're pouring for people, when it comes to you, somebody else has to pour your cup of wine. So everybody has to be served, including the server. That's an important general principle. Also, I find that women often are very, they feel like slaves. They're still in Egypt, they tell me. So you got to remember these things. So it says, Mazgul lo kosrit rishon. And it's translated, they poured for him the first cup. That's not what Mazgul really means. Mazgul means mixed. That's what it means. It means mixed. And then Rashi says there in the Talmud that they mixed because in those days the wine was so strong that it was always cut. And therefore they mixed it with water. So that's then, I think, the people in the class said, well, probably the water wasn't that good. That's why people drank wine. And so then there's a value to having water in your wine because you're getting more water from it. Because you need the water, too. You need to consume water. And if you drink too much wine, you vitiate or you have too many problems. It's too alcoholic. So, you know, there may be another side to it.
So custom in Japan, if you have dinner with Japanese business people, they don't pour their own. It's not polite.
That's right.
Pour your own for somebody else.
Correct. The Japanese are experts in politeness. That's a very basic piece of their culture, and always have to pour for somebody else. Exactly.
There's one interesting thing in this whole collection of Mishnah, which for the most part is totally, it's a simple principle and it's common sense. It's just behave yourself. You know, don't try and trick anyone. So you can mix things or you can't mix things. Or you know, or not. But the basic point is, if you're trying to fool somebody, don't do it. And if you're not trying to fool them, and it's a normal thing, then yeah, fine. But the one unusual thing here, I think, is the part about selling the adulterated, let's say, or selling wine mixed with water to a merchant. We shouldn't do it because he's only doing it to fool other people. But of course, if his plan is to mix wine with water, he's going to do it anyway. Right? He doesn't.
Maybe.
So maybe this is also a warning or a suggestion, or a suggestion that it's not enough just to worry about yourself. You should also not participate with others.
Somebody else's deception. That's correct. It's going to be very
irresponsible.
Correct. When you sense that in business, let's say, that you're being used, you know, that's a very basic issue we're living with today. It's a lawyer's problem. Lawyers have to be sensitive to that in their practices, that somebody is really using them. Regulators are in the business of trying not to be used, but they're used all the time. And then just we count people. Sometimes you have the feeling. You got this problem when you get these guys out on the street who were this morning, or was it raining early this morning? Or maybe it was yesterday morning. It was raining. It's raining a lot. So I'd come after the minyan. I'd buy the Israeli paper. I'd go up to 86th Street, and every morning I'd buy Yediot Achrona. Nearly every morning, so I'd get up to 86th Street. And the guy's calling out up there, umbrella, umbrella, umbrella. you know the routine. So in a lot of parts of the city, too, every once in a while you have a feeling you're dealing with stolen merchandise. And when you as the consumer, when do you make that judgment? And how much evidence do you need to make that judgment? But it's something you should be thinking about, because you don't want to participate in someone else's improper behavior, and in fact end up encouraging it.
Well,
generally, there's
many of those.
How many of the
government
terrorist trade?
The new bootlegger.
Maybe you had another reason. Another reason it's not good.
they're acting documented.
I doubt this guy selling umbrellas
was
doing that. He's not doing that. But my concern always is that they not be stolen property. Okay? Very good. We go on. Let's start the Gemara. Tanu Rabbana. Rabbi stopped. Okay? We have a Beraita. Ein tzarich lamar chadashot me arba vishanot mishalosh. It is, you don't really have to say that if there is new grain from a cheap pot priced at four seah for the seller, that is to say, in grain, it's in bushels. In the Hebrew for bushels, more or less, is seah. It's a seah. Okay? So that's about the size of a bushel. So if you're paying four sellers, like four shekels for the bushel, one kind. You're paying three shekels for the other kind. Which is the more valuable? The one you're paying three for or the one you're paying four for?
It's like 33-cent pieces or quarters.
Exactly, because
four for a dollar or three for a dollar.
So the three for a dollar would be the more valuable one, right? The three for the dollar is the more valuable one. So in other words, that's what it's saying here. Ein tzarich lamar chadashot me arba. Obviously, if you're getting four of the new ones and you're mixing it in with three of the old ones, then you're diluting the quality. Okay, because the three of the old is going three per bushel, the new is going four per bushel, so obviously you're diluting the quality. So that's easy. So you don't have to even say that. The ein me'arvim, of course you don't do that. That's plain logic. Ela, rather, afilu chadashot mishalosh v'yishenot me'arba. But, even where you have knew that three per seah, three per bushel, and old that's four per bushel. Oh, this is old. This is not selling to it. All right? You have new that's more valuable, old that's less valuable, you can't do that either. Now, you might have thought from what we read in the Mishnah that surely you could do that. All right? Now, here it says no. You're not allowed to mix those two. Because a person wants it to age. Namely, the old stuff, even if it isn't as valuable, still, it's not the same stuff. He's going to have to let that whole thing then age. Because it's not worth it to him until it gets older. So there are two issues there. One issue is that he's going to mix then different ages of things. And two is that he's not going to be able to do this. He's not going to be able to use it until the stuff gets old. So a basic issue here also is time is money. Time is money. And there is a value to something. How do you say that in business? There's a way to say that. What do you say? The time something of money? What is that called?
Time
value.
The time value of money, right? So that if you have money today, it's worth more than having money a week from now. Because in that week, you've made more money with that money. So it's the same thing with the grain. There's a time value to the grain that, in fact, you process. And certainly if you're a merchant, that's an issue. You're trying to process this. You want to get the maximum amount of flour out of it. And one of the issues is simply an issue of time. And time is money here. There's a time value to money. Okay? So on both those scores, that is an issue. And see, that's not so intuitive. The intuitive one was easy. Where one thing is worth less, and you can't put that in the thing that's worth more, that's obvious. But even given the opposite, where you have another issue, that other issue is also a determinative issue, and therefore you can't do the mixing without the knowledge of the party. Okay? Questions? Yes.
In the Mishnah, they have an instance where you can't mix water and wine, water and wine, sell it to a merchant unless you inform each customer. So there, as long as the customer is being informed, it seems to be it's okay to do. But you don't have that kind of, relaxation here.
Yeah, that's true.
In these other instances.
That's true. I don't know what the reason for that is, but I assume that it's the reality of dealing in these different businesses. But I haven't really thought it out because I don't know what it is to deal in those businesses. But you're right, there is a distinction.
You said that in regards to wait for the product to dry out, but what happens if the merchant decided, you know what, I don't want to wait. It's not worth for me to wait. I'm going on vacation. I want to sell it. So he mixes it and he sells it.
The merchant.
The originator, the first person that, because we know we are not allowed to do it through the tagar, through the middleman. But the original merchant, we are talking about the mixing, about not to take four with three or three with four, because sometimes you want to wait the time and to sell it as a dry product. But let's say the original guy that is the merchant, doesn't have the time, and he starts the process, but then he changes his mind.
But realize,
then he wants to get rid of it quicker. So
remember that there's a difference between wheat and wine. What we read first in the Mishnah is about wheat. Then when we get to the subject of wine, Mishnah Nitarebo Mayim Biye No. Okay, the person who has water in the wine, lo yim karena b'chanut, can't sell it in the store, ela im kein hodiyo. V'lo letagar af al pi shahodiyo bo. So that's only as far as wine goes. Wine.
Now I'm talking about the 3 and 4 about the bushels of something I want. It's fresh and the other one is old and it was in process to get dry.
Right.
And I'm going on vacation and I need the money.
Right.
So I stop the process and I mix it.
Can't do that.
I'm doing that the other way around.
But you can't do it. Because now you're, in a way, putting the buyer in a more difficult position. Right? The buyer is in a difficult position because he whatever he wants, whatever he's going to do with the produce, he assumes that what he's paying is what he's going to be using the produce for.
But when you dry a process, when you are in the process of drying, you can see that this is fresh and this is in process to dry.
Maybe not. I don't really know. But I assume the answer, I assume that you can't. I assume that it's not very obvious. Instead, you have to know what's going on. But it's not very obvious.
Rabbi, I'm reminded of when we studied the laws of marriage and Kiddushin, and you mentioned it earlier, though, one of the three ways to acquire a bride was and that's often in the form of a wedding ring in our culture. What you taught us was that it had to be pure gold, or that it couldn't have any stones in it. And the reason for that was that you had to be, the woman, or both parties, I guess, had to know the exact
value,
whatever that was. It had to be pure, at the point. So it strikes me here as the same thing, that like whatever you're selling, it has to be what it is, old grain or new grain, and not some mix. And that seems to me, I don't know if it's a pattern throughout the laws of transaction in the Talmud, but to me the wine diluted with water is still wine. One could argue that a dilution is still a pure thing. It's just, it's the same thing, but less of it, let's say, but not altered otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to me, it's just kind of an interesting association. I don't know if it's valid.
I'm not sure either. That's interesting. Henry,
I was just going to clarify. The situation here is the key thing is what's the purpose for which the buyer wants this. He wants to mill the grain. He's buying the old grain at the price of three, is it There's no reason why the seller would mix expensive stuff into the cheap stuff unless he probably didn't have enough of the quantity that he needed to sell to this buyer. So he'd say, I'm gonna fill up the rest of the basket with the new grain, and he puts it in there, and then the buyer is not getting what he wanted. He doesn't care that it's more expensive. What he cares about is he wants to mill this thing right away, and he's not getting what he thought he was getting. So that's the critical thing. When you mix anything, regardless of what the monetary value might be, it could very well be not what this buyer intended, and that's the situation.
To that I say amen to be content.
Thank you.